Hello again, it's 34 Russell with Patrick Kelly, bringing Kansas wrestling to the world and the world to the Kansas wrestling community. Today's guest needs no introduction. He is a rare individual in our sport in that he not only is one of the most recognizable names and faces in wrestling, but also in the broader sports category in general. The guy has a statue in his likeness outside of Carver Hawkeye Arena, for crying out loud. So let's jump right into it. With us on the line is Dan Gable. Coach Gable, welcome to the program.
Hey, that was a great introduction. I appreciate it. Thanks.
From being on the front lines of the Save Olympic Wrestling movement in 2013, to working with the museum in Waterloo that bears your name, to being visible at many events and fundraising functions, you have kept yourself perfectly busy in retirement. Tell us why you feel so strongly about giving your time to keep the sport of wrestling alive and well.
Well, it's just like wanting to be the best in this, what you want to do. And so when I was playing baseball or I was playing football, I always wanted to be the best. But it just so happens wrestling was my best sport, and I was able to be the best there most of the time. And because of that, wanting to be the best, I still feel like the sport that kind of I loved. I mean, there wasn't a thing that I didn't love about the sport of wrestling. So I want to make sure it's offered to people that have that same feelings like I do. And then there's a lot of kids around the world that have those same feelings, but, you know, maybe not to the quite extent that I have them, but I wanted to make sure that I work at something that will provide and give to somebody for the rest of the time that people are born on this earth. And so that's what I shoot for. But I have to have support behind it to be able to get me to do this kind of everyday commitment to my profession. And, and so that's why I have to have family members that also love it. And because my family members loved it when I was a kid, and now they love it now that I'm a grown adult and I have grandkids, it just seems like it gives me that opportunity to do what I love, but yet not neglect what they love as well. So it's very important.
The National Wrestling Hall of Fame Dan Gable Museum in Waterloo, Iowa, joined forces with the National Wrestling Hall of Fame in Stillwater several years ago. And then it went through a flood and then a series of renovations, and it just went through another major renovation. It's now really a destination spot for the sport of wrestling. Give us your elevator speech on why wrestling enthusiasts should stop by for a visit.
Well, I'll tell you, it's not just about wrestling. It's more about excellence, and it's more about opportunity, and it's probably the only museum in the world that I know of that it's not only shows history of what you're displaying, which is wrestling, but it also has a actual wrestling complex in it to where young kids can come in or old kids can come in and train and get a workout. So we actually have renovated not only the updates for the museum artifacts, but we actually increased the size of the wrestling facility to keep and give more kids opportunities. But, you know, it's like history. It keeps getting updated. We just renovated, and so it's getting updated. It's getting renovated. It's getting a little more perfect. But then what is perfect? Well, perfect is something that quickly goes away, and there's something else that is more than the former perfect, and you have to stay up with the future perfect because things change all the time in science. So right now, you know, we have new champions that are happening all the time, and so you're going to have things that happen. But as I walk through the new renovation with the new museum director, which is Jimmy Miller, 10-time champ from Wartburg, a college coach, you know, we just look at the walls, and along with our money guy, Mike Doty, that helps raise money for the museum. And we see that, well, everything that we have on the walls aren't quite perfect yet. So we know that time changes perfection, but even there's some things that we have renovated that we need to change. So it's a constant type of making it better. And that's what I like about the people that are working there. And that's what I like about the future is that we're going to try to do a really good justice at the museum to the past, but we want to make sure we stay current, and we want to make sure that we bring in the future as well.
So it sounds like not only is it a destination spot, but something that people want to come back to in year after year even.
Well, the technology has been updated too. So it's not just what you go in and look at. It's what you can actually push buttons and see what's going to happen. And then you have to change that, of course, over time. But it's more modern, and it's not a one-time visit. It's if you want to learn how to wrestle, you've got to come to that wrestling room, you know, every day for 5 years. But if you want to see this museum now, it's going to take several stops to get it all, because it's a lot more than what it was before, but yet it was good before.
So in recent years, you have collaborated on a book called A Wrestling Life with Kyle Klingman, and followed that up with A Wrestling Life 2. You have a popular beer out from Single Speed Brewery called Munich Helles Lager, better known as Gable's Gold. You have new motivational poster, and you have videos out. I understand that the beer can only be purchased within Iowa at Hy-Vee grocery stores and other outlets, but is dangable.com the best place to purchase the books, posters, and videos?
I would say yes. I would say dangable.com is the best place to purchase that. For everything I've done in my life, books, posters, paintings, it's always been like a straightforward contract. You get a percentage that goes to here, percentage goes there, but you really know what you're signing, and you know what you're doing. But I'll tell you, this beer business, it's a little confusing. Even though for every beer that's bought, the museum benefits from that. It's been a very good opportunity for us to grow a little bit more. Even though I'm not trying to advocate beer and alcohol out there, even in the book, if you grab one of the books, there's an article about saying know your limits. And it's actually about one of the parts of the chapters is about if you do have a beer, there might be a limitation that you have to put on yourself. I know I had to do it, because if I didn't do it, I would have probably lost my marriage. I probably wouldn't have been as successful as a college coach. I probably wouldn't have been as successful as a dad. So there's many things that that like these books talk about that make you learn and understand a little bit about what it takes to be pretty good in life. Not that there's a totally, you don't put one stamp on anything, because everybody's a little bit different and go about it in a different manner. But there are some values that you have to have. And I think with the values that you'll learn from reading this type of book or understanding that painting, that it will help you in your own life see what is needed to make this world a little bit of a better place. And I think with all the controversy that's going on in the world with politics, being smart, it's about working together, and you'll never win a team championship with the way the business is being done in the political world right now. And, we don't want half the people fighting the other half of the people with their attitude. So somehow we have to have them work together. And I think that's what a good coach will do for a team, because if he doesn't, then he's going to drive a lot of the kids out. And you know what? I hate it when a kid quit on me. I mean, I had to look at myself and like, wow, what did I do to fail to make that kid quit? I don't want to run a kid off. I want the kids walking the hallway saying, hey, I want to go out for wrestling. I want to go out for wrestling. That's the one thing that my high school coach, Bob Siddons, really did a great job at. All the parents wanted their kids to go out for the sport because they were getting something out of it. And all the kids weren't competing. A lot of them were just going to practice. I remember one time we had to add about two more mats outside our wrestling room. I think we had 125 kids out one year. And you know what? I think 125 kids stayed, or actually by the time the end of the year, we probably added four or five, just because the word gets out. When you got a good thing going, when you got a good leader, and you got a good coach and a teacher, I tell you what, that helps the parents, and that's what people want to be associated with.
So most listening to this podcast know your story and can probably list your accomplishments. Those unfamiliar with your story can be caught up to speed by picking up those books. I'd like to take this interview in a little bit different direction and bring up a few scenarios from your coaching career and learn what was going on behind the scenes. My plan is to set the stage for the particular event and then let you take it from there. I came up with about a dozen, and we'll see how many we can get through. But I think a lot of people will have the impression that it was just, you know, the Gable aura or, you know, that Iowa style or some, you know, technique that you taught or whatever. But I think a lot of it was these relationships that you built with these kids and, you know, the way they manifested themselves. It just didn't seem like it was always about the X's and O's. So I have a few scenarios, and let's get through as many as we can. The first one, I have in my hand a Sports Illustrated dated March 22nd, 1982. On page 22, there appears an article called Look Homeward Hawkeye. And part of the article deals with the situation around Barry Davis's short departure from the team prior to leaving to the 1982 Big Ten tournament. He had mentally and physically broke and was intending to forego the when it counts part of the season. And who knows, maybe even his whole career. You sprang into action and found him at a grocery store purchasing a cart full of junk food and somehow got him to the Big Ten tournament. 2 weeks later, he won his first of three NCAA titles. As you look back on that incident, now almost 40 years ago, what do you think would have happened if you would have not found Barry to both of you and the team?
Well, there was a lot of things that happened in Barry's life that have been very successful. Besides being three-time national champion, besides being a world medalist, besides being an Olympic medalist, and besides being the coach of Wisconsin for many years and having All-Americans and teaching other kids. So I really think that had I not been able to corral him and get him to them Big Tens, because he was kind of funny because he just thought he could skip the Big Tens. And that's what blows my mind, is that he was thinking that, well, I'll just go to the Nationals. I'll win the Nationals. I don't have to win the Big Tens. But that's how much communication that you have to have as a coach. You know, you got to have your athletes knowing exactly what you know and more. And I apparently didn't do a good enough job of making sure that he knew that he had to qualify at the Big Tens, which you don't now because you can get by with an injury or something, but I don't know about a runaway, but you know, he had to go to those Big Ten tournaments, and he had to place in the top four probably to go. But it was one of these things that right away, as soon as I found out he was missing, there was a letter on his locker, and you know, basically what it did was he had learned from another athlete who kind of pulled the same type of thing, a guy named Dave Fitzgerald. And so he thought he'd pull a Dave Fitzgerald and just kind of give us a note and then wish us good luck. And actually, Dave, I don't think he even gave us a note at that time. He just disappeared. But anyway, and there was a successful story with him as well. But Barry, no, he had a coach that used to like to watch Sherlock Holmes, and there's a deductive type of reasoning. You kind of have to sit down and list all these possibilities, and then you get people to help you to go through all these possibilities. You can't do it alone. You've got to have a team. And so I called on the team that wasn't going to go to the Big Tens that day. And I sent the team on their way to the Big Tens, and I got some help immediately. It wasn't Dan Gable just looking for Barry Davis. Immediately, it was 20 other wrestlers and getting leads. And then we had Matt Aves, and we were getting leads. And then we had fans, we were getting leads. And so, you know, I stayed home, and I sat right at my desk, and I was answering calls and so on and so forth. Didn't have the internet and all that stuff then, so it was strictly by telephone or by word of mouth. And all of a sudden, I get a break. And the break was the night janitor, the And the night janitor was there from 11 o'clock at night to 7 in the morning. He said, yeah. He said, I don't know if it was Barry, but somebody was in the sauna in the locker room about 4 in the morning or something like that. And so that gave me a lead to know where to start from. And so I started with that lead from the janitor. And then I got a notice from one of his teammates that he was in a certain area of a town at this person's house last night, but he was just there talking to him, and I didn't know exactly where it was, but they told me kind of what part of the town it was in, and so they gave me a name, so I pulled into a Hy-Vee. And when I pulled into the Hy-Vee, I was going to go to a paid telephone because I knew they had a telephone books, which people might not even understand what a telephone book is. But it was a big piece of notebook that you could open up and find somebody's name on it. And I had his name, and I was going to find out really only the address. I wanted to know the address to where this house was because I was kind of running it down. And basically, it put me in the same location as Barry because Barry, once he left the workout facility, was on his way over to this person's house, and he didn't know exactly. Well, he was actually going to stop at the Hy-Vee, but the Hy-Vee wasn't open till 7 o'clock in the morning, and so he kind of hung out in a apartment right across the street from the Hy-Vee and waited, and it was just the hallway until the store opened. And so it was about 7:05 and I was at phone book and I'm walking out the store and there he is going out the checkout line. So, wow, did I get a break? Wow. But it took all that Sherlock Holmes techniques. And there he was buying, you know, a lot of food, I guess, and drink, and he had it, and he looked, and I walked over to him, and he saw me, and he dropped the whole bag, and all this stuff come rolling out of this bag. I can remember donuts come rolling out the bag, and the big words out of Barry's mouth was, hey, I haven't ate anything yet. So, you know, that meant he was pretty close to weight, probably, because we were getting ready to take off, and he said, I am still overweight. He says, I said, Barry, do you really want to wrestle and go to this event? Because, you know, because you can't go to the Nationals unless you qualify. Can't. So I just show up at the Nationals. So that's where I learned I need a little bit, you know, more communication to my kids and being more informative. But anyway, I got himself and myself on a plane, and we stopped in Chicago. We had a 3-hour layover. We were just going to make it up to Michigan to the weigh-ins on time if everything was straight, but we still had weight to lose. And so while we were there in Chicago, we went across to a hotel, and I made him run the stairs so he could make it because he wanted to. We had to lose some weight. And then we went down, I believe there was an exercise room, and believe it or not, we worked out, and he checked his, and again, when I was keeping my eye on him pretty close, because even though he said he wanted to participate and do this, because if he didn't, he wouldn't have done it. But I still, you know, just wanted to make sure. So when we were running, I made him run in front of me always. I didn't lead the run, so I just ran him up these stairs. And then we I got him on a scale in one of the hotel's locker rooms. And he was right on weight. And so we caught the next flight, and we landed, and we threw to the weigh-ins, and I think we were down to the last 20 minutes of weigh-in. I think we had an hour. You got an hour to weigh in or something like that. You had to weigh in from, like, a certain time, and you had an hour to do it. Unlike today, you couldn't do it because you had to be there for weigh-ins at the time. Once you get in line for weigh-ins now, you got to weigh in. But anyway, so he made the weight, and he won the Big Tens. And 2 weeks later at Iowa State University, he won the NCAAs. And I tell you, it was pretty emotional. In fact, when I got to the national tournament, I said, Barry, you're going to be all right the night before. He goes, yeah, I'm going to be all right, coach. I'm ready to go. And I said, well, if you want to, you can sleep. I got an extra bed in my room. Me and my wife are in there. If you want to sleep in that extra bed, just to make sure that you stay within the realms of what you need to do to make weight. He goes, you're glad to stay there. He said, no, coach, I'm fine. So anyway, about 10:30 that night, there's a knock on my door, and I open it, and it's Barry. And he said, coach, that offer's still open. I better stay here. So he stayed in that bed that night and slept there. And I think I might have had another room with kids there, my kids. But anyway, it worked out. He won the Big Tens. He won the NCAAs. He silver medals, I believe, in the Worlds. I believe he was silver medals in the Olympic Games. And coached for many years. It was his profession. And he claims, had I not found him, that it would have changed his life big time. And I agree. You know,
wow! Wow! What an amazing story! And you know, I got to ask, what Coach Barr and Joe McFarland? Because Joe McFarland, I believe, is who he would have had in the finals. I wonder what they were thinking, and did they put up a protest at all? You know, because obviously they saw that you and Barry were not with the team initially. Was there any controversy around that at the Big Tens?
You know, there's word of mouth stuff happened, but those are the old days. You know, it's a lot different today. Certain things, but I don't think there was anything that was, nobody could have badmouthed us, because you could weigh in up to an, you know, you had an hour to make weight. So unlike today, you've got to step up and get one chance or maybe two chances on the scale. And that's about it. But anyway, there's a lot of things different now because you weigh in close to the competition. Back in those days, I think you weighed 5 hours before or the night before. And so there's difference of times, but no, I don't think there was anything that was illegal. I think it was all good, just good coaching, you know, that you know your kids and you get a little lucky. I mean, once in a while, when you do things right over time, wow, some crazy things happen that are in a positive way. So if you didn't really have that knowledge and you didn't have the background and if you don't do the extras, you don't get lucky. Even though I don't like the term luck, but I have a feeling I was a little lucky on going into that Hy-Vee store just looking for a phone book, and there he was. So I could have missed him. And if I'd have missed him there, there's no way that we were going to make in that flight to make the Big Tens.
Wow, what an amazing story. Amazing story. All right, let's move on. Joe Gibbons is one of the most notable wrestlers in the wrestling-rich history state of Iowa. He won 4 state titles, was an OW at the Junior Nationals, and heading into his senior year at Iowa State, he was a 3-time All-American and defending national champion. Ironically, current Iowa State head coach Kevin Dresser was your guy at 142. To set the stage, Dresser was also an Iowa boy, in the same recruiting class as Gibbons, but not nearly as sought after as the blue-chip recruit that Gibbons was. Further, in college, Dresser had earned his first All-American honor during his junior year when he placed 4th in the same weight class that Gibbons won. Back in that, in the era that the Donnybrook, which is the Iowa-Iowa State duel, there was a home and away duel each season. In 1986, Gibbons and Dresser were seniors. The first duel was in Iowa City in January. The second was in the closing days of February at Hilton Coliseum. Gibbons and Dresser wrestled to a tie in the first duel meet in an era when overtime wasn't wrestled in duels. In the second duel, the Cyclones broke a 2-year, 36-match win streak for the Hawkeyes, but Dresser pulled an historic upset over Gibbons in the 142-pound matchup. Dresser went on to beat Peter Yazzo of Lehigh in the NCAA Finals weeks later, after the Engineer had beat Gibbons in the semis. To me, this seems to be an example of a breakthrough win that elevated Dresser to a new level and set Gibbons back on his heels a little bit. How did this scenario play out from your perspective?
Well, Dresser to me is, you know, instead of me really understanding and going to that actual matchup with Gibbons, I know more about Dresser. And I really don't know a lot about Gibbons, except, you know, because they were the opponents and they were good wrestlers, and there was, I don't know how many of them, 3 or 4 of them, and they're still into the sport. So, you know, the Gibbons names, you know, is huge. And I feel like Dresser is the guy that I can focus on. And by that, I mean, again, all of a sudden you got a guy that's probably like a two-time state champ, maybe. I'm not even sure on that exact thing, but he comes in and Dresser alone is like, when I visit him, his house, what's amazing is that I stayed at his house all night, which, you know, I don't think is legal anymore. My parents actually wanted me to stay there. I was there late at night and they just said, stay here. We got an extra bedroom. And I think maybe my wife might even been with me, but what's amazing is that, you know, back in the old days, there's certain things that you could do and now maybe you can't do them. But Dresser was one of those guys, along with, I think, the Zadigs, Bill, probably, that I stayed right at their house and then stayed all night and end up developing a relationship with the kids and with the family, and I'm sure it helped. But Dresser was a kid that, you know, he came in and he was, I mean, I think he was at Iowa for 3 years. And I think it was his fourth year because he went 5 years of eligibility, redshirted 1 year. So, you know, I think he was wrestling behind very good wrestlers. I think one of the guys I think he was behind was like Lenny Zaleski, three-time All-American, member of the I think there was three Zaleskis that wrestled for Iowa too, but there was a lot of competition in that day, and Dresser had the ability to weather the storm, and he stayed there, and he didn't wait his turn, because I always told people, I don't want you to wait your turn. So even if you have a national champion in weight class, you got to go about figuring out how to beat that national champ to get, and that would increase our chances of being a great team. Instead of having just one kid, we have two kids that are wanting to, you know, win national titles. And even if he's the two-time champion, you know, if that's your weight class, you know, you either go up or down or you beat the kid out. And Dresser actually was having some trouble, you know, beating kids out. And he was sitting on the sideline. And I don't know whether he ever contemplated transferring or anything like that. But he stuck it out, and he actually had an injury that was bothering him pretty bad, and we really weren't diagnosing it correctly. And I think that went on for about a year. And finally, he was right, because nobody could find out what was wrong with his arm. And finally, after about the third or fourth trip, they found it, and they had a surgery on it. And you know what? It made a difference. The kid was right. Sometimes you got to listen to those kids. Can't just make the diagnosis from yourself, or even if the doctor says, "Oh, this kid," you know, sometimes they don't lie. Sometimes they might. But Kevin Dresser is one of the guys that once he got an elbow repair, it made a difference. He could actually hold up more. He could do more techniques. He was better conditioned, a little stronger. And first time he got to wrestle when he was fourth year. Junior, and he placed fourth in the NCAA's his first appearance. He had the patience, which I don't like the word patience, and he probably doesn't either, and I'm sure he had turmoil because of the injury, because of getting beat out, but still doing pretty good, and you have people that can step in and do well. So his first national tournament for Iowa was his fourth year, and he got fourth, and we probably did well. We did. We won the NCAA's. So then the next year in 86, it came right down to the last 20 seconds of the match. And he was one of our five champions we had that year. But he hit one of the most perfect moves and executed it under the at the best time of the match to win the match, because he was down by one. And he hit the head outside high crotch type move, where he cut the corner perfectly. He didn't get in there and push and pull and get caught. He just hit the corner, cutted it, switched across, finished at the knee, and got the guy down to win the match. Yazzo, like you said, from Lehigh. So the Gibbons boys, you know, I don't, you know, I I don't know if I, some matches I remember, some I don't as well. And these are the ones I remember more about Kevin Dresser. The Gibbons, obviously, they're on different teams. Had they been on my team, I would have remembered the Gibbons matches as well. And I do remember some of the great moves that the Gibbons brothers did. I remember Jim Gibbons skying people on high crotches. And that's how, you know, Randy Lewis's arm got dislocated, because on the way down, he posted his elbow from about being 10 feet in the air. And so, yeah, you do remember certain things, but some of them you don't want to remember because it wasn't a season-ending injury. But yeah, that was the only year that Randy really didn't make the finals. And basically a year he should have probably sat out and redshirt, but he came back and All-American, but he only had one arm that year. So anyway, that's kind of my story with Dresser. Got Gibbons in there a little bit, but that's what I'm recalling about Kevin Dresser. And the reason why Kevin Dresser is so important is that he's done such a good job for our sport everywhere he's went and since he's left here. And now he's at Iowa State, and you know what? They're coming back, and it's going to be some really dandies in the future with the Branzas and Dressers and Iowa State. Even with Schwab at UNI, I'll tell you, you know, he's getting some – he don't lay back either. And so we got some of that good attitude out there. And I'll tell you, we need it, you know, because we're not – Penn State's winning it. Of course, you know, they got a great coach there in Sanderson, but he's an Iowa Stater as well. But that's what you got to thrive on competition, and that's where we're at right now. But we don't like – the state of Iowa doesn't like taking second or third or fourth or whatever they're doing. And the future looks a lot of fun. So,
yeah, it sure does. I mean, that Iowa-Iowa State duel last year was just a very good one, reminiscent of back in the 70s and 80s for sure. So last two questions. Both deal – a little bit with Oklahoma State. I want to ask you about the NCAA tournament in 1989. I believe that would have been your lowest placing. I think the team took seventh, and that would have been Joe C.
Who recently... got sixth. Didn't I get sixth? I hope so.
Was it sixth? Okay, maybe I'll have to fact check that one. Yeah.
It's either sixth or seventh, but I think over the years I've been preaching sixth, but if it's seventh, I'm still going to go with sixth.
Okay, okay.
Question me.
But Joe C.
But it was low. It was low. It was the only time we never got a team trophy, so.
Joe C., who recently passed away, won his first of two NCAA titles that year. He won back-to-back titles in 89 and 90. But my question to you is, how did you turn things around during that 1989 tournament to the next year and beyond? Was that a real milestone for you, a real marker? Just what feedback did you get from that tournament that year that caused you to kind of take the program to a new level?
Well, that's a great question, because the bottom line is when you get a chance to bottom out, that's when you really get, you should take that opportunity, even though you should do it every year, even if you're at the high level. But realistically, you don't have those same feelings inside of you. You got to feel that pain. And when you feel that pain, then you can really think better. And you can really go to a deeper level. And you're not just going to get by, you know. And so you're really going to do what you plan on doing. And so to me, that was my low point in coaching. I remember watching the NCAA finals, and I don't think we had anybody in the finals. And that was pretty lonely for me. I just, you know, hit rock bottom. But I had to analyze. I couldn't just, we're going to do this and this. I had to deep think, and I had to do a lot of communicating, and I had to do a lot of research in my own mind. And you know, we had a couple young kids on the – well, we had Tom Brands. And Terry was sitting on the sideline that year. But I believe Tom Brands ended up third in the nation or fourth that year.
Fourth to Jimmy Martin.
Okay, by Martin, yeah. So he got beat by Martin. But he was probably the piece that I looked to that made me say, I got to have more of this on the team. The other guys, good guys. they needed more help too. Because I don't know if you know this, but we ended up going into that national tournament, even though we didn't have a good year early, we ended up going in as one of three teams that were favored to win the NCAAs in 89. And we didn't even come home with a trophy. And we had beaten the teams that took first and second back-to-back days. Of course, it was in Carver Hawkeye Arena on a Friday and Saturday or a Saturday and Sunday. We had that little aura there that probably made the difference, and I probably didn't think about that. I was probably pretty confident going in that we could win. But I had to break it down after that loss and realize that I actually needed some more people on the team with a certain attitude that was basically missing to make that makes championship teams. And even though we had some guys on the team, you don't take anything away from that, but everybody's got a personality. And a lot of times if that personality doesn't fit the needs of the team, then you're going to probably not reach the goals as easy or as hard as they have to be. And I needed more leadership at that particular time. And it was probably one of the reasons why I had a couple kids coming up that were so crucial to our program in the future. We had both brands that were going to be there, but we also needed these kids named Steiners from North Dakota, Bismarck, North Dakota. The brands were offering a lot of toughness to the team. The brands were leadership in some attitude type things from strength and go power and stuff like that. But what I thought was needed was that dedication, that work ethic, that early morning before you go to class or night after practice or even within practice or even right after practice, where people just didn't leave when you blow the whistle, say practice over, they didn't leave. Or in the mornings you go in the locker room, if you didn't have a scheduled practice in the morning, where you'd see kids in there, you have this example. And sometimes when you win quite a bit, you kind of, after a while, you float a little bit and forget about what the ingredients are that really builds and makes and continues to keep a program going. And so, I felt like we had some pretty good leadership at the beginning with the brands, but only one of them was there, and he was fourth place at that time. And I really felt like we needed what actually back in the day when we first started getting good, what Jay Robinson from the University of Minnesota actually he went to Oklahoma State, and then he went to the Munich Olympics in Greco, and then he came to Iowa as a graduate assistant, and he was my assistant coach for a long time. But he really was a taskmaster. He was in the Army, and he would run a lot of the morning workouts, and he would figure out what each guy needed to do from a technical point of view and a tactical point of view. And so those morning workouts were so crucial. And what was needed was not just those morning workouts, but how hard you worked at them. And the Steiners were like nonstop workout people. I mean, they could go and go and go and go. And I heard stories. One of the stories I heard was I think, I don't know which one it was, but one of them just had read, I don't know what he had read. I don't know if he read something about me or if he read something about somebody else. But in high school, he was going to, instead of go to bed at 10:30 at night, he was going to ride his exercise bicycle, I believe, all night till 6 o'clock in the morning or something like that. Something crazy. And, it was like one of those bike-a-thons or a marathon or whatever. But he was going to ride it all night long. And, for me, it's like when I think about it, that's probably not the smartest thing to do. But, maybe early season or maybe some off-season time, you want to set a goal and want to do something extraordinary. But when I heard he rode the bike all night long, I said, wow, I mean, that's tough, you know, especially he's not out on a bike where you're driving through the woods and you can see bear or, you know, wherever they were in Dakota, you know, you can see the out of doors. I mean, he was on a stationary bicycle. I mean, what the heck are you going to see there? I mean, I don't think, you know, maybe he was watching TV or something, but probably not because I was going all night long. But you know, back in those days, they may not have had TV going all night long. But anyway, so, you know, that's kind of the stuff that this team brought, you know, after 89. And guess what? I kind of got off my butt, too. I was kind of too confident that we just win every year. Because, you know, you started winning, and you get a streak going, and you know, so sometimes you got to go out and do a little more work. So instead of sending some of my assistants out more, I actually went on the road more and recruited more, because the chances of me landing a kid was probably a little bit better with me in their front room as compared to an assistant. So sometimes you got to look at your own self as well and see what you can do to increase. And I'll tell you what, I had a couple teams during that era, after that every weight class, it was just like, wow, you got this guy. You know, you got Chad Zapito, then you got, you know, you got the Brands brothers, and then you got the Steiners, then you got Strikers, and you got the Rylands, and you got the Chelsvigs, and you got Pfizer, you got Sherritt, you got Ohlsdorf. You know, all these guys, you know, were, and each one of them weren't automatic by any means. And some of them, you know, never did win an NCAA title, but I'll tell you what, they went a long ways. They put up third place points. They put up fourth place points, you know, those types of things.
Before we move on to the next question, again, Josie recently passed away. What's your biggest reflection from thinking about Josie and the way that he conducted himself as a coach?
Well, I'm going to tell you. I mean, there's not a thing I don't like about it. I really don't. The only thing I would say I don't like about it is somebody else don't like it. No, then obviously they haven't saw what I have seen or been involved with what I've done. But Josie was one of those guys that reminded me of me when he really liked the sport, and he really liked his athletes, and he was genuine with them. Even though he was at a Division II level for quite a while, winning a lot of national titles before he won the Oklahoma State one. You know, I was associated with him a little bit. He was quite a bit older than me, but a little bit as an athlete. But more than that, his coaching is what made him. He really enjoyed the sport, and he worked hard at it, and people respected him for that. And when somebody puts their life, soul, and work ethic into something, I usually get a lot out of it, and he definitely got a lot out of it. Josie was a wonderful guy, and me and him might have got into it a little bit, but only when he went to Oklahoma State, just because, you know, that's the nature of the conflict, competition. You know, it's got to be deep, and when it's deep, there's a little conflict. So,
well, thanks for that that reflection. Last question. So early in February of 1984. The Hawks traveled to Stillwater and were soundly defeated by the Pokes 24-6. Current Oregon State head coach Jimmy Zaleski kept his personal win streak alive by winning in a last-second 3-1 victory over Bill Dykeman. And Dwayne Goldman, I believe, was the only other Hawk to claim an individual victory. You had been named the head coach of the Olympic team that year and were preparing for the 1984 Los Angeles Games. You took somewhat of a lead from the team and put Jay Robinson in charge of the day-to-day operations of the Hawks, and you focused on the Olympic team at that time. After that loss, I believe you jumped back into it and spent all of your efforts on the college side of things. What did you do in that final stretch of that 1983-84 season to prepare the team to capture the seventh straight NCAA title in a dominating fashion by 25 points over Oklahoma State in that national tournament?
Well, I tell you, you know, one of the first things you had to do was anytime you designate somebody else to run the show and you have a lot of confidence in them, and it's not quite going quite as well as you want, which could happen with you in there as well. You got to do a really masterful job of making sure that you communicate and that you work with that guy that's running the show, which would happen to be Jay Robinson at the time. And because, you know, all of a sudden you just go in there and you take over and stand him on the sideline. You know, that's it's not the way things work. I had to go in. I had to convince Jay by how this was going to happen. So I had to spend a lot of time making sure that he knew that nothing to do with him as compared to what's called perception. Perception is reality in a lot of cases. And so I convinced him that it wasn't really that I was coming back, which I did, because there was only the last month of the season, and there really wasn't a whole lot of time. But I think besides that, I didn't have a whole lot of time to really do what maybe I didn't do for the last 2 months with Jay at the helm. I said the perception isn't going to be as much for our team, but yet there is some there, and they're going to actually probably feel good that Coach Gable's coming back to help out because they're struggling a little bit. They need some help. But really, the perception was going to be for the rest of the wrestling world out there. And that perception was going to actually make a bigger difference with the enemies, or I shouldn't say the enemies, the opponents, in that, oh my gosh, you know, they've got this streak going, Gable's coming back, oh, we thought we had a shot, you know, well, no, we probably don't. I was just trying to make it as easy as I could and still keep in reality without actually upsetting a coach and upsetting a team. And everybody had to kind of understand that concept a little bit, but I didn't really explain it as much except for the coach, to the coach, because I didn't want that word out there and beyond Coach Robinson and maybe the other coaches that were on the team as well. So when I came back, I mean, I actually flew back, and I really only flew back to watch. I mean, we weren't doing that bad. We were having a, you know, not a, a banner year yet, but we were doing pretty good. And all of a sudden, though, in that Stillwater duel, there were so many things that went wrong. And there were so many things that, even though the refereeing made a difference, and it could have, that if I would have said, okay, we still should have won, even with the referee's calls, even with the referee doing this or the crowd doing this or whatever happens, because we're in visiting country, enemy territory, you know, it's, we should be able to overcome that. And we should be able to walk in to a hostile environment, and that's where we should thrive. And that's the way I did as an athlete. I loved that. You know, when I went to Russia, that was my favorite places to wrestle, because there were 10,000 Russians rooting for the Russian and not me. And yet I was able to get them to convert to yelling for me and being happy with me. But they were not happy that I beat them, but they were happy of performance. So when we got to Stillwater, I really only watched that match and took it in. And then it was after that match that night, and that hours after, where all of a sudden I had to come back and say, Jay, we got to do something. I mean, did you see how we reacted once what something went wrong? It kind of just was like dominoes. And so, I mean, it was, I didn't want to wait too long either. So when we got him up, ran him hard, took him out in the Holiday Inn yard or whatever hotel we were in there, right in Stillwater, Oklahoma, and we wrestled in there hard. And we start, and I told him, guys, I'm coming back. Coach Robinson's he's okay. He's with me. He's still right all along with us. And we're going to train the next month, and we're starting right now. And I didn't have much time to lose, because it was late in the season. And I'll tell you, when, if you would have watched that performance the night before, you could have thought that this team, there's no way this team's going to do it. But But Robinson knew better. He knew they were just close, and they had an off night. But you know what? You can't have an off night, especially that late in the season. But it's happened before, and we came back other times. But really, it was a remarkable turnaround. In fact, it was such a remarkable turnaround that Oklahoma State, I believe, changed coaches after that season, and they offered me the job down there.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But I all I had to do was go to my wife and find out, did I want to keep my wife or did I want a new job? So didn't take much there to make sure that I stayed. But it did give me an opportunity to finally get a bonus. And by a bonus, I mean a raise a little bit, just because I didn't really even look at it. But when the word gets out, you know, and there's a word that maybe somebody wants you somewhere else, they offer you a little more money. So I finally got a bonus after, I think, 7 championships or so. But not that I was complaining, but I just didn't know the difference. So.
Well, Coach, I appreciate you taking your time to join us today. And I hope we can do this again sometime, because I have several more questions that I would like to cover with you. So it was an entertaining and information look back. Thank you for all you do to promote the sport.
Well, I tell you, Pat, as I head out here, you know, you said you were going to have about 12 questions. I think we went over about 4, so I think we got time for about 3 more podcasts. But we'll do that in the future. This is a lot for the people to actually listen to and then listen to it again, because you know why? You know, it's just like when you're drilling, you got to drill once, twice, 3 times, 4 times, and then it gets up to 1,000. Well, you know, there's a lot of information that people can give in a lifetime of wrestling. Thank you.
This has been 34 Russell, bringing Kansas wrestling to the world and the world to the Kansas wrestling community. Until next time, thanks for listening.